This is KMUN News. I'm Skylar Butenchin. It's Thursday, February 26th. Oregon House lawmakers voted Tuesday to increase the state's lodging tax. As Bryce Dole reports, the money would go toward wildlife conservation and to help ranchers whose cattle are killed by wolves.
36 lawmakers voted to increase the tax on stays at campgrounds, hotels, and vacation rentals. The bipartisan bill funds state programs addressing everything from poaching to wildfires to invasive species. The debate over the bill centered on whether funding for Oregon's wildlife and natural resources should come on the back of the tourism industry. Critics said raising the tax could harm Oregon's economy and place jobs at risk. But supporters, including hunters, environmentalists, and cattlemen, say the 1.25% tax increase is needed to help hundreds of threatened species in Oregon. Democratic State Representative Ken Helm spoke on the House floor before the bill passed.
Trust me now. It is a mistake to let this opportunity pass by today.
The bill now moves to the state Senate, where it died during last year's legislative session. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
A Northwest tribe is asking the federal government to reconsider a massive energy storage project it licensed earlier this month. NWPB's senior environmental correspondent Courtney Flatt has more.
The Goldendale Energy Storage Project in South Central Washington would shuffle water between two reservoirs. It would generate energy to back up other carbon-free wind and solar power. Recently, federal regulators gave the green light that paves the way for construction. But the Yakima Nation says the project will be built upon incredibly sacred land. The tribe says the project would ruin seed banks that have sustained cultural food since time immemorial. The Yakima Nation also argues the federal government didn't fully consider their concerns before it issued the most recent license. The tribe and the environmental group Columbia Riverkeeper are requesting a pause to any development and a new hearing on the license. I'm Courtney Flatt.
Last year, the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians petitioned the Oregon Marine Board to impose a motorized boat ban on the Upper Siletz River in Lincoln County. The board is expected to issue a temporary rule at its meeting in early April. KLCC's Brian Bayhuth reports.
The tribe's petition would ban motorized boats upriver from Jack Morgan Park, which is about 6 miles north of the town of Siletz. They say a ban would help preserve salmonid spawning areas and prevent user conflicts. Hanging around Jack Morgan on a recent Sunday, a local fisher told me he uses a drift boat and oars to fish for salmon and steelhead trout. He puts in 13 miles upriver from Jack Morgan at Ohala Park and fishes while he drifts with the current. At Jack Morgan, he takes his boat out of the water and trailers it back up to where he puts it in the river again. Motorized boats have the ability to drive upriver, and that's why he supports the motor ban. But the issue is particularly contentious in the Siletz fishing community, so he does not want to be identified for fear of retaliation.
I think it's a good thing because, you know, the way the river is, you know, and it keeps the pollution out of the water, you know, and plus, you know, you ain't getting the you know, like if you have a motor down there, you can motor it back up, and you're getting other people's way, you know. That's what a lot of happens, you know. But, you know, when you're going upstream, that's kind of messing you up, you know, messing up everybody else, you know, I think.
Lingering at Ohala Park, I met a fisher who launches his motorized drift boat at the park and fishes for salmon and steelhead with his family and says he's never had a conflict with anyone else on the river. He, too, does not want to be identified for fear of retaliation.
The current regulation should stay in place. Motors should be allowed exactly how it is now. This is a political user group issue. This has absolutely nothing to do with saving fish, water quality. This is the tribe trying to get their foot in to ban all non-tribal users, the public, from accessing a public resource, which is this river.
Part of the problem is that the Siletz is a premier fishing destination, and guides who use motors contend they'll be financially impacted by a motor ban, but the tribe counters that guides using oars will take their place. Dr. Angela Sondanaz, Natural Resources Director for the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians and a tribal member, she emphasizes that the petition puts the resource ahead of temporal profit. She's quick to restate the tribe's objectives amid the hyperbole on social media.
We are not anti-fishermen. We are not anti-guide. We're fisher people ourselves. And so we appreciate the people that appreciate that activity and the joy and the subsistence that it brings to people. We want everyone to enjoy this river and its resources, but it has to be done in a respectful way. And it has to be done in a way that doesn't negatively impact other users.
The tribe operates a hatchery and employs fish biologists to monitor, better understand, and manage important river species. Sondana says the proposal to limit motorized boat traffic upriver of tidal influence is not indiscriminate or avaricious, but a matter of science.
It's a matter of physics. You can look at these things. We've taken video in the water column of boat motors moving through up through a riffle. And you can clearly see with your own eyes the effect it's had on those gravels. And those gravels are where our fish spawn.
The Oregon Marine Board has never considered a petition from a sovereign tribal entity, which comes with a learning curve. In response, the board impaneled a rulemaking advisory committee to consider the petition and make a recommendation. The diverse group of stakeholders met four times since last July, and at the end of January, the facilitator recommended the Marine Board take a hybrid approach in managing the Siletz, like they did on the Rogue River, where motors are restricted depending on factors like river flow and the season. The tribe's petition would divide the river into two zones, one motorized and one not. Dr. Sondana says the rules are culturally and scientifically reasonable, easily enforceable, and unambiguous.
We stand behind our petition and the request that was made very clearly in that petition. And if a compromise is to be considered, the foremost question I have is, does it adequately address the problems that we're trying to address with the motor ban? If we're not safeguarding salmon reds and sensitive life stages, if we're not addressing the social conflicts that motorized use has created on our system, then we're not, a compromise is not a solution. It's just kicking the can down the road for future conflict and future resource issues.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission is expected to issue a temporary rule at its next quarterly meeting in early April ahead of a series of public meetings. A final rule is expected in the fall. I'm Brian Behuth reporting.
Earlier this week, 35-year-old Joseph Tyler Beaumont of Gearhart pleaded guilty to sexual exploitation of children and possession of child pornography. A federal grand jury in Portland returned a 6-count indictment charging Beaumont last May. Investigators found files of child sexual abuse material of multiple minor victims on a thumb drive that belonged to Beaumont. He will be sentenced later this August before a U.S. District Court judge. As part of the plea agreement, Beaumont has agreed to pay restitution to the victims. The FBI is investigating the case with assistance from the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office and the Gearhart Police Department. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian. Read more online at dailyastorian.com. The Washington State Legislature held a public hearing Monday regarding a bill that would dramatically change eligibility standards for elected sheriffs. Senate Bill 5974 also looks to give the state a path to remove elected sheriffs from office if they don't meet new requirements. Democrats say the bill is a necessary measure to hold sheriffs accountable and help build public confidence in policing. Opponents say the bill takes the power of firing a sheriff away from the public. The packed hearing was attended by Pacific County Sheriff Daniel Garcia, who testified against it. Garcia was previously a senior chief in the Navy with no background in law enforcement. He told lawmakers he only ran for sheriff at the urging of supporters. The contentious bill would require candidates for sheriff to have at least 5 years of uninterrupted full-time law enforcement employment, along with obtaining specific state certification. The original bill, upon passage in the Senate, would have led to Garcia's immediate decertification, but an amendment was accepted by the House Committee on Community Safety that any current sitting sheriff would not be subjected to the 5-year law enforcement rule. However, any future sheriff candidate would have to meet that benchmark. Groups testifying in support of the bill included the League of Women Voters, Faith Action Network, Alliance for Gun Responsibility, and Northwest Progressive Institute. As of Wednesday, the bill is still waiting for a vote in the State House. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Chinook Observer, online at chinookobserver.com. Washington's lands commissioner is warning budget cuts could lead to state-owned recreation sites closing this summer. Dave Upthegrove says the House and Senate budget proposals released this week cut spending for maintenance at parks and other state-operated recreation places.
If those aren't reversed through the budget process between now and the end of session, we're looking at closing about 10 or 11 recreation facilities and limiting the hours and services on many more.
Upthegrove says his agency's maintenance operations funding was cut by 20% last year for the current budget. And he says budget writers are proposing another $750,000 reduction for the next fiscal year. Washington state officials caught more than 800 Japanese beetles in South King County last year. They're now gearing up to spray 2,000 lawns in the area with pesticides. KUOW's John Ryan reports.
The shiny green beetles have infested the eastern U.S., where they're considered a highly destructive pest. Officials have been spraying lawns in Oregon and central Washington for a few years to stop the plant-chomping invaders. But this would be a first for western Washington. Agriculture officials think the beetles hitchhiked in on an airplane. Most of the spraying is planned for the Angle Lake area, just south of SeaTac Airport. Pesticide would only be sprayed where property owners give permission. Officials say this pesticide is safe for humans, pets, and wildlife, but other insects like pollinators and butterflies could be affected. If you find a Japanese beetle and want to kill it without pesticide, just drop it in a bowl of soapy water. I'm John Ryan reporting.
Coast Salish peoples in the Pacific Northwest have been weaving robes, blankets, and shawls for centuries. They use wool from wild mountain goats and, in the past, from a dog breed that is now extinct. The exhibition Woven in Wool, Resilience in Coast Salish Weaving at the Burke Museum showcases this artwork and documents how it's being kept alive. More from KNKX arts and culture reporter Freddie Monares.
Inside a dimly lit room at the Burke Museum are blue, red, and purple braids of wool paired with materials used to dye them, such as berries, alder cones, and red mushrooms. Delicate older garments are displayed proudly alongside young, vibrant threads, including a shawl and small bag created by Kelly Sullivan using a technique called overspun.
When you take it off the loom, it's like the spirit comes to life for the weaving. And when you do those little twists, it's almost like you can see it. Like, it's transforming.
She says the material sort of dances around and comes to life. It's her favorite part of the weaving process. Woven in Wool, Resilience in Coast Salish Weaving features new pieces like Sullivan's alongside 30 loans of historic robes, capes, and regalia from museums in Canada and across the country, some dating back to the 1800s. The Smithsonian loaned the museum a pelt from a woolly dog, a breed that is now extinct. And these dogs were kept by Coast Salish peoples for their hair or wool. This pelt is the only known specimen in existence. Some of these older pieces were used by tribal officials when meeting dignitaries. Others were used in ceremonies or, more practically, to keep people warm. Sullivan and other weavers studied these pieces to make new work. She says the show is a way to share the practice with others and to preserve it.
I hope in 100 years someone's learning from this dress and this shawl and this bag, and they're trying to figure out how I did it, just like I wonder how they did that.
Katie Bunn-Marcuse is with the Burke Museum. She says the museum paid for weavers to study older pieces and select what they wanted to feature at the show.
This group met with us over and over really consistently. All the decisions were vetted and made by them. The vision was really led by them.
The weaving process starts outside, where weavers spend months gathering material, such as finding mushrooms when they're the right color. Susan Pavel is on the Weaving Center's board.
What we wanted to also lift up was process and all that it took to bring a robe of protection or a dress for a ceremony or leggings for protection to life. It's many, many steps to get there.
Pavel is Filipina and married into the Skokomish tribe. The late Skokomish artist Bruce Miller taught her how to weave in 1996, leaving her responsible to teach others. And back then, Miller, who Pavel refers to as uncle, was one of only two people in the state teaching weaving.
I feel like Uncle like reached into my soul and lightly just tapped there and ever so slightly pulled out this silver strand and laid it out in front of me. And there's this silver strand that I walk upon, and sometimes I stop. And sometimes I fall down. And sometimes I've been pushed off. And it's not always been easy.
Pavel says she's dedicated herself to weaving by striving to be the strongest link in the chain of knowledge. She sees indigenous culture being revitalized in other ways, too.
We know we're doing the work. We know pieces of our knowledge have been woven back together again because I can see the young ones who are growing up in our longhouses, who are singing our songs and dancing our dances and in our ceremonies, and it's normal for them.
Pavel says the art form isn't meant to stop with her. She's developed the Coast Salish Wool Weaving Certificate at Evergreen College and says she plans to teach more weavers for as long as she can. In Seattle, I'm Freddy Monades.
You're listening to KMUN. Up next is the American Democracy Minute.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In his State of the Union address, President Donald Trump pushed Congress to pass the Save America Act, now before the U.S. Senate and unlikely to pass. But to justify it, he repeated his unfounded claims of widespread non-citizen voting.
And perhaps most importantly, I'm asking you to approve the Save America Act to stop illegal aliens and others who are unpermitted persons from voting in our sacred American elections. The cheating is rampant in our elections. It's rampant. It's very simple. All voters must show voter ID. All voters must show proof of citizenship in order to vote. And no more crooked mail-in ballots except for illness, disability, military, or travel. None.
There is no evidence of widespread non-citizen voting or other election fraud in American elections. 1 in 9 Americans don't have ready access to citizenship documents. An estimated 69 million married women use a name different from their birth certificate. And only half of Americans have a valid U.S. passport. In 2024, 30.3% of ballots were cast by mail with no widespread abuse. We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN news team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchin, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.